Craig and Karen Kaler are the toast of their small southern town.
I was probably a little jealous of him because he had a beautiful wife, three fabulous kids.
But over time, the illusion crumbles.
Their life was seeing the front of a beautiful house, but the backyard is a mess.
Beneath this perfect facade lies a dangerous mix of sexual obsession and violence that will destroy everything they have.
It's just total shock.
There is no comprehending it.
Love may be blind and marriage bliss, but divorce is murder. In 1983, Craig Kaler is in his junior year of engineering at Kansas State University when he meets beautiful first-year student Karen Lee Hetrick. Karen's younger sister, Lynn Denton, remembers the young couple falling madly in love.
Their relationship grew and blossomed while she was at school. He came to our house to visit the family. And was excited to see them and big sister coming home and woo, has a boyfriend. And I just remember her happy.
Craig is at the top of his class.
He was so smart. He is just super smart and successful in his field, excelled in everything academic.
When Craig graduates, he's offered an engineering job in Colorado. After dating for a year and a half, Karen leaves school and marries Craig. The couple move to Colorado to pursue Craig's career. They seem happy and even give birth to their first child, a little girl they name Emily. Their marriage appears flawless. Shortly after the move, Karen's mother spends a weekend with them and notices some unsettling behavior from Karen.
My mother had made the comment that she would hop up and serve him whenever he would suggest. My mother had mentioned that she thought it could be problematic, that it could be an issue.
Despite early concerns, in the years that follow, Craig and Karen seem happy and welcome two more children into the family, their daughter Lauren and son Sean. In 1999, 17 years into their marriage, an opportunity comes that Craig cannot pass up. He's offered the prestigious position of Director of Utilities in the conservative town of Weatherford, Texas. The Kalers lose no time in making Weatherford their new home. Karen heads up numerous community-related organizations, including the local mom group. Karen's good friend Leslie Edwards describes Karen as a key member of Weatherford society.
She was really great at organizing, and in the community she was big. I mean, she was just a way of pulling people together.
Weatherford resident Sherry Coles and Karen become close when their kids become best friends.
If she decides to do anything, it's either full out or she didn't do it at all. So whenever she decided that she would be president of the Moms Club, she was full out president of the Moms Club, organizing things, making sure things happen, getting people involved.
Sherry's daughter, Chaney Coles, is Emily's and Lauren's friend and bandmate.
Emily and Lauren and I had a band. It was called Days Off. We played a lot of places in Weatherford. And we basically got our version of small town famous.
They were practicing one day at our house and Karen came in to pick up Emily, and she sat back and she listened to them for a while. And she said, "Oh, you guys need help." And that was it. She was in and she was practicing with them and she was teaching them and she made sure they got their rhythms down and got their harmonies right. And from then on, she was the band mom.
Karen was amazing. I love Karen. We called her our mom manager, and she was always there at band practice to help us push forward. She was always looking for new ways for us to play.
For his part, Craig is described by his neighbor Norman Edwards as hardworking and successful.
To me, Craig was just a normal guy. He liked to play baseball. We played baseball with the kids. He loved to take his son fishing. He even taught him how to fly fish, hunting. He bought a go-kart.
Craig is very much the provider for the family. He really took that as a big responsibility and seemed that that was really, really important to him.
He'd work on their cars or if they needed help with cleaning, getting the boats ready to take to the lake. And yeah, he was a regular, you know, dad.
What wasn't so regular were the restrictions Craig placed on Karen. She has a strict allowance, and Craig goes through all her receipts.
Even though there was plenty of income coming in, everything that she purchased, whether it be for the family, the kids, or for herself, had to be accounted for. It was everything. Clothing purchases, grocery purchases, everything.
Karen's friends soon notice that something even stranger is happening at the Kaler household.
Well, we could never call the house after 8. And the first time I did, she grabbed the phone and was whispering. And I said, "Karen?" Because it was like 8 o'clock or just a little after 8. And she goes, "I can't have any calls after 8. Because Craig and I have to be in the bedroom at 8:30 because we have sex every night at 8:30 and is expected."
Just about everyone knows about this rule in the Kaler marriage.
He had expectations of her every night. Everybody knew it. Neighbors knew it. Kids knew it.
Everybody just kind of went, okay. And it seemed odd, but, you know, they were happy with it, so who am I to criticize? Karen was never, you know, it was not like, "Oh, got to call Craig," or, "Oh, got to tell him where I am," or anything like that. That, you know, some people in controlling relationships have to do.
I asked her, "What if you don't feel like having intercourse that day or sex with your husband?" And she says, "Well, I've learned a long time ago that it makes my life a lot easier to do it." I said, "Well, what if you feel bad? What if you're sick?" She goes, "I better be on my deathbed."
Forensic psychologist Brian Russell and psychotherapist Stacy Kaiser believe that the Kalers have created a set of unrealistic expectations for their marriage.
I think that people often start out in relationships and marriages doing things that are simply unsustainable for the long haul.
Karen and Craig had very traditional, stereotypical roles initially, where Karen really deferred to him, his needs, his wants, his rules, and that worked for her at the beginning. But eventually, if that's not really who she is, a completely passive person, then something's gotta give.
Their perfect life is closing in on Karen, and she starts to look for a way out.
Jenny was an escape. She was an escape from the family stress. She was a safe place.
The Kalers are picture perfect. Craig is a successful engineer. Karen is busy running a mom's group and the kids' neighborhood band.
They were the Leave It to Beaver family. They were the perfect little sitcom family.
They had the perfect house. They lived in the new addition. He had the perfect job. It was something every wife would want.
Craig and Karen are so good at keeping up appearances that no one notices the cracks in the veneer. In reality, their relationship is on the brink.
I was over for coffee, and she had mentioned that Craig was asking her to do something in the bedroom, and sexually, that she was not going to do.
Karen finds Craig's demands increasingly strange and unbearable.
It was because he wanted to bring a third person in, and he just wanted to watch.
I said, "Karen, you are married, that is true. But if he wants you to do something that you don't want to do, it is still your right to say no. You don't have to do what he wants you to do right now. You don't have to.
When you get into a marriage, you form sort of a contract. Not just a marriage contract, but a contract of how your relationship is going to go. Who's going to take out the trash? How often are you going to have sex? But what I see happening over and over again in relationships is that oftentimes one person wants to change the contract. And most of us don't have the skills to sit down and say, hey, look, I don't want to do it this way anymore.
Karen decides she needs an outlet and sets her sights on getting a personal trainer at a local gym. Craig won't give Karen money for the membership, and so she has to raise the money on her own.
She'd make cakes for people and get enough money and get herself a personal trainer. That way, there was no accounting for the money.
Before long, she's a gym regular. Craig accepts her new interest as long as she's home on time to take care of the kids. Karen totally throws herself into working out and is soon hired as a fitness instructor. Then, she meets a woman who will change her life forever. Her name is Sunny Reese. She's a beautiful fitness instructor at the gym, and she and Karen become inseparable.
Their interests were obviously this similar. They were both interested in fitness, and they were doing the same kinds of work and passionate about the same kinds of things.
Over time, a more intimate liaison between the two women develops.
Sunny was an escape. She was an escape from the family stress, escape from the marital stress, and she was a safe place.
It would be really, really hard to live with a person who was that controlling that much of the time. And I think she was trying to figure out how she was going to give herself some sort of release and make herself feel better.
An unfortunate amount of the time, I don't think people necessarily go out in search of a new romantic partner. They go out in search of social support. But they create a risky situation as they do that and end up in an extramarital affair.
When the neighbors find out later about the affair, there is endless speculation about whether it was Karen or Craig who instigated the lesbian relationship.
There was different opinions, there was different stories, there was stories that were just so far out there. And then there were stories that were right on. And if someone came to me with the story, I corrected them. No, that's not how it happened. Craig initiated this, not Karen.
Some people believe Craig initially encourages Sunny and Karen to be intimate because he wants to watch them have sex.
He encouraged them to have their girl trips, their girl weekends. He encouraged their relationship to grow. Which was kind of strange.
Karen told me that this was her reward for being a good wife and mother for all these years. I thought that was awfully odd and inappropriate. Something was definitely wrong within the marriage.
Others contend that Karen introduced Craig to Sunny and that he was trying to include himself in Karen's new relationship.
I've been told, I don't know directly, that Craig was completely aware of the relationship and that he was perhaps interested in being part of it.
I always think that neighbors and friends think they know a lot about what's going on in someone else's relationship. But the truth is, most of us know very little. Ask yourself what your neighbors really know about you. When I hear neighbors and friends recounting stories, what I know is that it's their perception combined with what they think that they heard.
Karen told me she fell in love with her. I asked her, do you love her? And she said, I do. She fills the void that Craig doesn't fill. Did I want to fall in love with her? No. Was my intention to fall in love with her? No. Am I a lesbian at birth? No. This is a choice. I've chose to be a lesbian, and I love Sunny.
I think that there's a possibility that she is a homosexual and was not in touch with that because she was young when she met him, or because she believed in sort of the illusion of family and felt like she needed to put those feelings aside and go have a husband and children. Generally speaking, I don't believe that you just wake up one morning and become a lesbian.
Sunny and Karen's relationship, initially accepted by Craig, and maybe even created by him, is now out of his control. He is perturbed about it, but totally helpless.
Craig was getting a little jealous because of, I guess, how close they were getting, and he knew Karen was falling in love with her.
He had a plan for what he wanted this relationship to be like, and it didn't go that way, and it kind of blew up in his face.
The conservative town of Weatherford still has no idea about the love triangle that is unraveling next door.
I think that Craig and Karen are master illusionists. Despite the tensions that they have going on at home, they're able to present this front of perfection and happiness to the point that all of their friends and neighbors think that they're literally the perfect family that everyone would want to be.
I've made the analogy that their life was like seeing the front of a beautiful house. Gorgeous. Everything's perfect, immaculate, in its place. Spectacular. But the backyard is a mess. So whatever everybody sees is awesome. But the stuff you don't see was a complete wreck.
When a job opening comes up in Columbia, Missouri, Craig takes it. It's an opportunity to get Karen away from Sunny and from Weatherford.
I think he was hoping that the move would fix everything. And I think his hope was, with separation, everything would go back to, quote, normal.
Karen is upset that he is uprooting her life and family, but Craig insists.
And it felt like home to her, and she made it very clear she didn't want to leave. But of course, he didn't care. He was the man in the family, and they were going to do what he said to do.
But when they move, Karen and Sonny's relationship simply continues long distance through emails and visits. The affair is about to send the marriage off a cliff.
I've never given anybody a bruise because I've hugged them too hard.
Despite the turmoil caused by the affair, Karen and Craig still maintain the facade of a happy couple and charm their new neighbors in Columbia, Missouri. But the relationship deteriorates when Craig realizes that Karen is still in touch with Sunny. He begins to monitor her activities.
Craig went through Karen's purse and found a birthday card, or it could have been a Valentine's card, I don't know, it was a card, and Sunny had sent it to Karen and just loved Sunny. I mean, it was just like a girls send each other cards for holidays, and he threw a fit. But he'd go through her purse, he would check her emails.
The marriage comes to a head on December 31st, 2008, when Craig and Karen return to Weatherford, Texas for a New Year's Eve party. Sunny is there.
Well, that New Year's party, I wasn't there. I was in the middle of taking down my Christmas tree, and I get this call from Craig, and he tells me that my sister's doing horrible things, and I sympathize with him for a moment. The gist I get is that there was drinking going on, and that Karen and Sunny were holding hands, and Craig didn't like that and thought that their behavior towards one another was inappropriate and embarrassing to him.
They were holding hands and touching each other and flirting, you know, just flirting, and it was obvious. And, you know, when alcohol's in play, you let your guard down a little bit. And so Craig just felt the need to announce to everybody that Karen had been having an affair with Sunny.
I think that she had reached her tipping point. I think she had decided that she didn't care anymore. She wanted to be free. She wanted to do what she wanted to do, and she didn't care who was watching.
Craig realizes the image of his perfect marriage is now shattered. What up to now has been a carefully kept secret between the three is made painfully public. The fallout from the kiss leads to what friends describe as the worst New Year's ever.
The town of Weatherford was shocked. It was something that just doesn't happen around here. If it does, it's swept under the rug. We just don't talk about it.
Craig is distressed by the turn of events and that their secret has been exposed.
The perfect facade was being cracked. And the public could see what maybe he didn't want them to see, and he was embarrassed. It was an embarrassment for him.
He created this, and then all of a sudden it's falling apart in front of his eyes and in front of friends that he wanted to carry on the facade of the perfect family with the perfect children and the perfect house, and it wasn't perfect.
Here we have Craig, who we know likes to be in control, and he likes to have his wife under his thumb. And now we have her beginning not only to slip away, but blatantly pull away. She's making dramatic moves to get away from him and go into the arms of someone else. Any person that is as controlling as Craig would begin to panic and begin to get anxious.
That was probably somewhat of a tipping point for Craig in terms of where his anxiety had been and where it was going to spike after that.
28 days later, Karen Kaler files for divorce. She moves her bed into another room and starts sleeping there. Craig calls all of Karen's relatives in an attempt to salvage his crumbling marriage.
It was devastating for him. He never really understood why she would want to leave him. The pervading theme in all of his communications was, I don't understand why she wants to leave me. I don't understand why something else would be better than me. You need to talk some sense into her. It wasn't just me he would talk to on the phone or email. He called everyone in my family. He emailed everybody, friends of Karen's. Just a huge campaign, I would say, of trying to get Karen's circle of family and friends to say, hey, you need to go back to Craig.
It was going pretty quick. It had gone from seemingly comfortable, happy family to moving out, getting a divorce in 6-8 months.
By March 2009, the couple is in the throes of a nasty divorce, and everything is in dispute. Money, the house, and child support.
He was not cooperating. There were different dates that certain things were to have happened by, like he needed to have a lawyer by a certain date, and he just didn't.
Craig was very worried about Karen wanting all the money and worried about his savings program and worried about what they had in their savings account, and he just did not want to share anything with her or the children.
Craig's state of mind darkens. He's obsessed with Karen, and he is tracking her every move.
Well, he had all this equipment from overseas came in, and I think at one time he may have even put, like, hidden cameras in the house.
He started breaking into her email accounts and looking and accusing her of having relationships with other women in Missouri.
Spent his time at work searching the internet for ways to break into their computers. He knew every word they wrote to each other. She changed her email address several times.
Craig was following one of her new friends, and this friend let Karen know, hey, your husband's been hanging out on my street. What's up with that?
Craig is relentlessly stalking Karen, and I think it's because he has literally become obsessed with her. He has nothing else left. The worst things about obsessions are that they feed on themselves. So once you begin thinking about it, it makes you think about it more and more and more. And it's literally like an elevator rising higher and higher and higher to the point where the person feels like they literally lose control of their own emotions.
Get your hands off me, stop it! Listen to me, Karen. We're gonna deal this on our own.
On March 16, 2009, Craig and Karen have a fight in the house. Karen calls the cops, and Craig is arrested on suspicion of third-degree assault charges. Craig claims that he hugged his wife. Karen claims that he assaulted her.
Whether it was a hug, whether it was a missed whatever, I've never given anybody a bruise because I've hugged them too hard. It's one of those, as domestic violence is, happens behind their home doors. So my word, your word, his word, hers word.
I always say that there are three sides to every story. There's his side, her side, and the truth. And I don't know if we'll ever really know what took place. What I can say is this. Things are definitely escalating to unusual points in this relationship.
When Karen moves out and rents a small house in Columbia, Craig falls apart.
She said, "Something's going on at Grandma's house. Something bad." I said, "Okay."
The relationship between Craig and Karen Kaler takes a dramatic turn for the worse after Karen has Craig arrested for domestic violence. Karen and the three children leave the house. Craig becomes depressed. He has trouble coping and begins to suffer from anxiety. He sees a doctor who prescribes him anti-anxiety medication. Craig is so consumed by his failed marriage that it severely compromises his work.
He had a binder that he would carry around and show people pictures of his perfect family and say, "Look, why on earth would anyone want to leave this?" And it became an issue that his boss had to address. So he was having trouble at home and at work dealing with it.
In September 2009, he's asked to resign.
The longer you maintain an illusion, the more drastically it hits you when it starts to fragment and go to pieces and fall apart, and the more drastic response you may have.
Losing everything, his wife, his family, and his job, Craig, at the age of 48, moves back in with his parents.
It was his whole life that he had built, he had worked so hard for so long to have was crashing down, and he was having trouble.
He had a vision of what his family should be, and it was crumbling.
He was so proud of being the perfect husband, and then Karen leaves him for another woman. That's a total slap in the face for a man, you know. Once he realized that she was not coming back in his life, and his pride was hurting him so much that it was turning to anger and hatred, and then all kinds of feelings started coming out in him.
Craig loses interest in seeing his daughters and chooses to only spend time with his son.
He called Emily little Karen. It was like he had this rage that he could no longer distinguish between Karen and Emily. It seemed like after they moved, it was a wholly different person, really.
They would call or text and he wouldn't respond. It seemed to them that he wanted nothing to do with them, the girls.
This is a perfect illustration of where narcissistic injury turns into narcissistic collapse, where somebody has become more interested in the maintenance of a facade than of actually being the person behind the facade.
He's now been humiliated. He's trying to figure out what he's going to do to make himself feel like he either has control over her or control over the situation.
On Thanksgiving weekend, 2009, Lynn invites Karen to join her for the holiday in Derby, Kansas.
I Facebooked her and I said, Thanksgiving dinner's at noon. How many plates shall I set? And she said she had her and the girls and Sonny, so add that many plates and we'll see you then. So I had a whole house full of people, and we had a really excellent time.
Karen's son, Sean, meanwhile, is spending Thanksgiving with Craig. Karen wants the entire family to visit her grandmother during the holiday, so the next day, she decides to pick Sean up from Craig's parents' house in Meriden, Kansas. Lauren, Emily, and Sonny are all in the van with Karen. They're very nervous. Craig's escalating obsessive behavior towards Karen has put everyone on edge.
I talked to her Tuesday before Thanksgiving, and I asked her, "Aren't you afraid? Karen, aren't you afraid Craig's going to hurt you with kids?" And she says, "Absolutely. Absolutely, I'm afraid he's going to hurt us." And I'm like, "Well, be very careful Thanksgiving weekend." And she said, "Well, we're going to meet at a place to exchange the child, and I won't be by myself." But that was a touchy situation. Sonny was with her when they exchanged the child, so it was kind of awkward, I imagine.
Sean gets in the van without incident. Karen heads towards her grandmother's house, 30 miles away, in Burlingame, Kansas. That evening, Karen's sister Lynn gets an alarming phone call. Something's wrong.
I got a phone call from my aunt. And she said, "Something's going on at Grandma's house. Something bad." I said, "Okay."
That Saturday evening, November 28th, 2009, at around 6 p.m., Craig drives to Karen's grandmother's house. With a semi-automatic rifle in hand, he enters the house without warning.
We knew about Grandma and Karen and one girl. There was no report of a second girl going to the hospital because she was already dead. They didn't take her to the hospital. She was just on the floor. But I called their cell phones because I didn't know which girl it was, because I thought the other one maybe got away. I said, "This is your Aunt Lynn. Call me. I know you're scared, but call me." Now I was thinking about my nephew and where was he, and I called the Kaler house. I said, "Where is my nephew?" And they couldn't figure out why I was calling and why I was looking for him. And I told him at that point, I said, "Your son shot my sister."
Craig shoots his ex-wife, Karen Kaler, her grandmother, Dorothy White, and his two daughters, Emily, 19, and Lauren, 16. He shoots seven times, and all seven shots reach his four intended targets. They are all killed, except for Karen's grandmother, who dies 4 days later at the hospital. After a frantic search, their son Sean is finally found at a neighbor's house.
He had run away barefoot and coatless to the neighbors to call 911. He was in their custody, protective custody.
Even more frightening, Craig has disappeared, and nobody knows what he'll do next.
He was pretty mad at me. He was pretty mad at Sonny We didn't know if he was going on to do some more harm.
After an intensive 13-hour manhunt, Craig Kaler is finally found, wandering on the side of a road, and is picked up by the Kansas Bureau of Investigation. Journalist Sanjita Shastri covers the Kaler story.
Kaler was a bit disoriented and had scratches on his hands and was a bit dirty. And the deputy asked Kaler what he was doing, if he was all right, and Kaler told him, "I'm the man you're looking for." When the police detective asked him questions about the night before, he told the detective, "I can't believe how fast you can lose everything."
Family, friends, and neighbors are devastated.
It was complete disbelief. Like, I mean, you see shows on TV all the time about things that happen. You see things like this on the news, but you always think, oh, that's terrible, but then go on your merry way. Like, you never think that's something that's gonna happen to you or someone you know or someone you're close with.
I thought I knew Craig very well, and I thought he was a loving husband and father. I thought he was the perfect man, and it was just total shock.
You can't understand it. There's no way to understand it. It doesn't make any sense. Because he's so logical and so rational. I can't understand it.
My dad knew that Craig hunted and was a good shot and had a gun collection. And my dad more than once told me, he said, "You know what? He's gonna hurt those girls. He is gonna hurt them." I said, no, he's too smart for that. He's too smart to do that. I was just sure that he would make a better decision than that. And my dad was right.
No one knows what Craig will do next.
The first week of December, I received a phone call, and it was Craig on the other end of that phone. He called my home from jail. He did sound very normal, and it took all I had not to blast him verbally, but I didn't really quite know what to say. He sounded like himself, and he asked if I was still working, and he thanked me for taking care of his son, and that's basically all he had to say.
Craig was an illusionist. He liked to create an image that was positive, make it look like everything was okay. He would get them on the phone and act like nothing had happened and try to make small talk. It was his way of trying to bring back some of the image and illusion that he had once created.
Or the psychopathic interpretation would be that he was trying to create witnesses who could say, "He called me afterwards and he seemed completely normal. He must have gone crazy a few minutes before when he did it."
Did Craig really go insane, or was this premeditated murder? Craig's future, in fact, his very life, depends on the answer.
The jury returned to the room after 2 hours, and Craig Kaler was simply staring ahead and did not have an expression on his face.
On November 28th, 2009, Craig Kaler shoots and kills his wife Karen, her grandmother Dorothy White, and their two daughters, Emily and Lauren. He's later arrested and charged with premeditated murder.
It was the why of Kaler's actions. Why had he done what he had done? Why had he committed the crime?
The small town of Burlingame, Kansas, is gearing up for their largest court case ever. The murders have stunned the tiny, close-knit community.
I got a sense of deep sadness and confusion as to what had happened and why it had happened.
In December 2010, Craig Kaler has his preliminary trial. He enters a plea of insanity, his only defense against the capital punishment charge. Whether or not he carried out the crime is not in question. The question is, was he insane when he did it? Friends and family notice Craig's unusual behavior during the trial.
Given the opportunity to speak to me, Craig would. Just silly things, he would say. It sure is a beautiful sunny day. I don't know if he was trying to use it as a double meaning, using Sunny's name in a comment to me, or I don't know.
It was awful. As he walked by, he did speak to my husband, asked him how I was doing, which was odd.
It was strange to me to see him, you know. I would think that he would just sit over there with his head down and, you know, just kind of go through the motions of the sentencing, but he he just, even the remarks he'd make to his ex-sister-in-law and things like that, he just acted like nothing had happened.
Everyone has an opinion about Craig's plea of insanity.
I think he was very calculated. I don't think he's lost it. He's just, the facade of the perfect family is gone, so he doesn't have to pretend anymore. So, he is not pretending. This is who he is.
And it was probably always there. His eyes had always been cold. I didn't know him that well, other than my friend's husband, and I trusted him with my kids, but it was calculated. He knew what he was going to do, and he did it.
Well, something obviously had to happen because a man doesn't kill his kids. I mean, was he out of his mind? I'd say technically yes, because you don't kill, period. You don't kill people, and you don't kill your ex-wife, or your and you certainly don't kill your kids. So, yeah, I guess technically he was crazy, because no sane person would do that.
Can the defense prove that Craig had gone insane and save him from death row?
Defense attorney Tom Haney said that this was a tragedy, that it was something that shouldn't happen to any family, and that no person in their right mind could do such a thing. And that was really the core, I think, of the defense's argument, was that Craig Kaler was not in his right mind when he shot and killed four of his family members.
They claim that Karen's lesbian affair pushed him to his breaking point.
The defense was, I think, trying to paint a picture of Sunny Reese as a homewrecker. They were trying to paint her as someone who was introduced to the Kalers and who met Karen Kaler, and then caused a rift in Karen and Craig Kaler's marriage.
The defense cites the breakup of his marriage and the loss of his job as causing severe depression, which was left untreated. They point out that officers found a full bottle of antidepressant pills in Craig's car, prescribed a couple of months prior to the crime.
They found a bottle of clonazepam pills, which I believe are anti-anxiety medication. There were 30 pills and he hadn't taken any of them, and they'd been prescribed to him earlier, and so they were found in his vehicle.
The defense also argues the fact that he did not attempt to cover up the crime as a clear indicator that it was not premeditated. The defense attorney, Tom Haney, argues that everyone has a different breaking point.
Tom Haney pulled out a pencil and he snapped it in half to show the extent to which Craig Kaler had lost control over his mental and emotional stability.
In this case, his mental state was the best argument they had, and he certainly had enough in his history to make most jurors probably sit back and take a deep breath and think about how they might have reacted had their spouse engaged in the same actions that Karen had engaged in, and had their lives fallen apart the way that his did. Craig's best piece of evidence of his insanity is also one of the most frightening things about this case, and it's the fact that he killed his own children. There are jurors out there who do believe that no sane parent could pull the trigger and shoot his own children.
It's uncertain whether the defense's argument that he snapped will be enough to save Craig from death row.
In order to be criminally insane, a person has to have had no conscious awareness of what is happening in that moment. They aren't aware of driving up to the house, they aren't aware of grabbing the gun, and they aren't aware of shooting.
The prosecution counters that the defendant knew exactly what he was doing. They describe Craig as a hunter, consciously planning to use the weapons in the house for a singular purpose, to eliminate his problems. The prosecution points to other clear and damaging evidence of Craig's planning.
There was a lot of equipment in the car and in his Explorer. They found camping equipment, among other things. They found trail mix. There were maps in the car. They found a suitcase with money. And so the prosecuting attorneys used this as a sign that Craig Kaler had planned out what he was going to do after he committed this crime and that he had planned the crime itself.
The prosecution presents some disturbing evidence. They claim that blood trails in the house indicate that Craig Kaler tracked his targets in White's home with a semi-automatic rifle and moved room to room as if it were a hunt.
He shot Karen and made her lay there on the floor and watch him chase the girls down and kill them. He made sure that she sat there and she could not move. He shot her in the back so she was paralyzed and could not move. He planned it exactly, and he made her lay there and listen to him kill those girls.
Craig shot 7 times and did not miss a target.
I mean, Craig didn't miss. If he had lost control of his decision-making and all of this, he would have missed his targets. There were 4 people in the house. He made 7 shots and didn't miss. There were no stray bullets. He had a long drive between his parents' house and my grandmother's house. That was a long time to sit and think. You don't just lose it and sit on it in that amount of time. And he had to decide to drive there.
In my opinion, he let Sean go. If he'd wanted to kill Sean, Sean would have been dead. And he was not out of his mind. If he was out of his mind, he'd have shot Sean.
The prosecution conclude their arguments with the dramatic statement that Craig didn't snap, that he was in control.
What we see is that he loaded his car with guns and ammunition. He drives an hour to the house where he knew they were living. He shot everyone but his son, and then after the crime, he said, "Oh no, I messed up." Those, to me, are all signs of somebody who was lucid and aware of what they were doing.
Craig's fate now lies in the hands of the jury. Are they convinced that he's a regular American guy who lost his mind? Or is he a cold-blooded murderer?
The jury returned to the room after 2 hours. And when they returned and each stood and gave their decision, Craig Kaler was simply staring ahead and did not have an expression on his face.
On August 25th, 2011, the jury rejects the insanity plea and returns a guilty verdict of capital murder.
Court sentences the defendant for the crime of capital murder to death.
On October 11th, 2011, the judge formally sentences Craig to death by lethal injection. An appeal is filed automatically after the sentence, no matter what. Craig Kaler will never go free again. His son, Sean, remains in the care of his grandparents.
The most frightening part of this case is you can have a man who is hardworking, seemingly connected to his family and his community, deteriorate to the point where he is taking a gun to his own children.
It's a more gradual, insidiously encroaching kind of a fear that your spouse could evolve from this well-put-together, well-behaved, respectable businessman into somebody capable of mass murder.
His old friends wonder if they will ever be able to forgive Craig.
You know, if there was any sign of remorse, any personal responsibility being taken on his part, I might, but there's not. It's not. I could feel sorry for him if I felt he felt something, but I don't think he does.
I just don't see how Craig could have done that. And I just can't fathom it. I still can't.
There is no comprehending it. I mean, it's just something I'm going to have to deal with the rest of my life. You'll never wrap your mind around that.
I was trying to think of a way to honor my sister. I mentioned it to Sunny, and she agreed that that was a great idea, to organize a 5K run to benefit a women's shelter. The Karen K 5K was a one-time event, but personally, I try to do a 5K run around her birthday or Mother's Day to honor my sister and nieces and grandmother.